Hi, everybody. I'm Larry R., and I'm an alcoholic. Well, I'll tell you what, a full room like this really does something for my ego, I'll tell you. All right, now, on with the humility. Boy, I'll tell you, I think before I get started and I get my couple of minutes up here, I'm just going to go ahead and start with our speakers. Our first speaker here is Bob O. Bob, please.
I was hoping for an empty room. Good afternoon. I am alcoholic. My name is Bob. I'm sober today by the grace of God and the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. Before I get going, I'm very nervous, and when I get nervous, I talk faster than a Newfoundlander in a pub on a Friday night. So I'll have to... I'll try to tell you a joke, and most of the jokes that I can remember and tell in public come from the grapevine. I'm not sure that this one does, but my ancestry is Irish, and I worked at Grapevine Booth a couple of times already, and I've met a lot of people from Ireland. Strange. But I think even our Scottish friends will enjoy this. There's a little town in County Cork, and in the pub every day sit four friends, and they get into their cups and they solve the problems of the world. There's Seamus and Billy and Pat and Mike, of course. So this one day they're getting at it, and they start talking about what's the fastest thing in the world. And Seamus says, "I think the fastest thing in the world is thought." And the rest of them said, "Thought? How do you get that?" He said, "Well, I'll be sitting there and a thought will just pop into my mind. Like, there's no time involved. It just, boom, it's there. And I think that's the fastest thing in the world." The rest of them said, "No, I don't think so." So Billy said, "I think the fastest thing in the world is the blink." The other said, "The blink?" Billy said, "We all blink like 100,000 times a day and we don't even know it. Like, our eye closes and opens so fast we don't even see it. I think that's the fastest thing in the world. It's the blink." Mike says, "No, I think you're wrong. I think it's electricity." They said, "How do you figure?" He says, "Well, you push the switch and the light goes on. You push the switch and the light goes off. And like, there's no time in between. It just happens right now." Patty's not saying anything. So they turn to Pat and they say, "Patty, what do you think?" He says, "Well, I don't know, but I kind of think it's diarrhea." So, of course, the three of them said, "Well, how do you figure that?" He says, "Well, Tuesday morning I woke up and I didn't feel too good, and before I could think, blink, or hit the light, I messed myself." So that's for our friends from over there. I belong to the High Steppers group in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, which is in District 2 of Area 91. Area 91 is the province. As you can tell, the Saskatchewan contingent is part of the Western Canada contingent that's in this room. We meet every Friday evening at 8 p.m. on 200 Main Street South in Moose Jaw. So if you're in the neighborhood, we'll be more than happy to make you welcome. The name of our group is High Steppers. Not because we're prancers or dancers, but because we read the steps in entirety from the 12 and 12. So we say, "Hi, Steppers." Now, I want to thank the General Service Board of U.S. Canada for the loving invitation to participate here today, I think. When I opened the invitation, I was excited until I read the topic, humility, this precious quality. Speaking about humility is not my forte. Perhaps the reason that humility is such a precious quality is that we as a fellowship in general find it difficult to speak about humility, lest we're seen to be blowing our own horns. In my part of the world, Whenever the subject of humility is proposed as a topic for discussion at a meeting, someone will pretty well put an end to the discussion by saying, "The trouble with humility is, once you realize you've got it, you've lost it." Although I don't agree with that statement, it does tend to drastically limit further discussion, and as in lots of discussion meetings, the topics in that meeting become numerous and varied, of course. When I started to put together some ideas on this subject, my first thoughts were of the definition of humility. There are a multitude of references to humility in our conference-approved literature, especially in Daily Reflections. In fact, in Daily Reflections, between July 8th and 23rd, there are no less than 12 references to humility in those readings. I did, however, find a definition of humility on page 58 of the 12 and 12. In the essay on Step 5, it states, "Humility amounts to a clear recognition of what and who we are, what and who we really are, followed by a sincere attempt to become what we could be." If only I could live this definition each and every day. From this and other conference-approved literature, what I've learned is that humility is not thinking less of myself, but thinking of myself less. This definition fits with my perception of our program of recovery. The steps and traditions teach me to have less of an ego by recognizing my limitations in living life as it comes, and to think of someone else instead of just thinking of myself, as I did when I was in the throes of my disease. Trying to follow the suggested steps of recovery and trying to apply the traditions to all aspects of my life lets me practice true humility by realizing that I cannot get and stay sober on my own. I must depend on the power of a group of sober drunks found in meetings. Most of all, I must turn over to my higher power all the people and circumstances in my life over which I have absolutely no control. When I'm on my knees having a conversation with the God of my understanding, and the reality of the magnitude of my powerlessness is evident to me, that is when I feel a sense of humility. To get back to the real topic here, humility, this precious quality, I need to look at why humility is a precious quality. Like everything else, humility becomes precious when it's in short supply, or when, for some other reason, it becomes valuable. First of all, I ask myself, why would humility be in short supply in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous? Stay with me now. In order to answer that question, I think it's necessary to look outside of our fellowship and take a look at our society and how we perceive that some of the things we grew up believing were just part of life in general. All through our society today, one of the things we are taught is that if we work hard, do things well, attain the required results, we will be rewarded, either by advancement in our chosen field and or by the recognition of our peers. This ego building is not conducive to developing humility, and therefore we as a society in general do not realize that we are lacking in humility. That's one reason why humility may seem to be in short supply, but is it really? Growing up with this concept of rewards for good work, I am not able to let go of this expectation just because I stop drinking and try to get sober. It takes time and practice of our 12 steps of recovery. Attempting to live by our 12 traditions also helps me realize some of the things I need to know in order to gain some humility. Remaining anonymous while reaching out to help others is not easy, but when it happens, a feeling of usefulness makes me grateful to my higher power for the opportunity, and once again, I feel a sense of humility. So now I ask, is humility really in short supply in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous? I think the answer to that question will depend upon who is being asked. In other words, each of us will answer according to our own perception of what our individual program should be at this exact point in time. How we measure up to our own standards and what our relationship presently is with those around us, and especially what our relationship is with our individual higher power. My perception of how much humility is evident in our program is governed by what my expectations are of myself. Most of the time, I feel that I'm lacking in humility. And if I'm judging others by my standards, I may be too critical of them because I cannot know what situations others are actually in or how they're handling them. Most of all, I'm not privileged to know what and how anyone else is doing something anonymously. Anonymity is our greatest means of achieving humility, and therefore the most effective means of keeping others from discovering that we as individuals are truly humble. As you can tell, this is leading to a cycle where anonymity is an aid to the individual attaining a feeling of humility, while at the same time acting as a cloak which restricts our ability to detect the humility which others feel. Once in a while, I'll hear someone express his or her feelings on a certain subject or situation, and I'll think to myself, wow, is that person ever humble? This is in no way a true reflection of whether or not that individual is actually humble. All I have now is my perception of what I see in someone else as humility. Probably what I see is what I think I would need in order for me to feel humble. So as far as I can figure out, I have absolutely no way of knowing how much humility there is in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And therefore, I can't know if in fact it is in short supply. The other reason that we may look at humility as being this precious quality is that humility has become valuable. Well, I don't think that we need search very far to realize that humility is a very valuable commodity. In this program of recovery, we as individuals strive to do the best we can to become responsible citizens and a part of Alcoholics Anonymous. We already have the alcoholic part down pat when we arrive at the doors of this program. What we need to work on now is the anonymous part. Being anonymous is the best way we can experience true humility. How do we become a part of this program? Well, in my mind, to become a part of means that I must get involved so that I can be of some help to others. I hear people say that if you don't drink and go to meetings, you'll be fine. That may be true for some. But in my case, I know what getting involved in our home group In my case, I believe that if I didn't get involved in my home group, I may not be sober today. Most of us know what getting involved in our home group leads to. When we're ready, service. Our horizons expand beyond our own comfortable home group, and we find ourselves getting involved beyond the group. We find ourselves getting involved in general service. General service in Alcoholics Anonymous affords a multitude of opportunities to be of service to others, and service provides the necessary cover for an anonymous activity within the program. I'm not saying that unless you're involved in general service, you won't have the opportunity to feel humility. I'm simply stating that being involved in general service provides much more opportunity to be of service. So now you're probably asking yourselves, what has this got to do with humility, this precious quality? As I see it, being of service to Alcoholics Anonymous provides opportunities beyond my capacity to imagine, to be able to experience that feeling of humility. We can begin at the level of our home group by looking at how we deal with the newcomer. Being involved in the activity in our group, we're able to greet the newcomer with not only a welcome handshake, but we will be able to inform him or her of the activities which they are invited to participate in at the group level. We can, by our behavior, become that attraction which will keep the newcomer coming back. The sense that maybe something I did or said is helping someone else stay sober brings me back to being grateful for the opportunity, and again, I again sense that feeling of humility. The realization that it is the opportunity provided by my higher power that put me in a position to be of some help is what really makes me feel humble. I had nothing to do with the newcomer showing up, but I was given the opportunity to help. I can't help but feel humble. Anything which I stand up and do at my home group is providing a service to Alcoholics Anonymous. If I'm able to take the key and open the doors for the meeting, set up the room, make coffee, chair the meeting, clean up afterwards, share, listen to others share, reach out to someone who's hurting, all these are opportunities to be of service. Being of some help to another individual makes me realize that I'm blessed to be able to be in this program, and then I feel humble. Because of the way we're taught to accept things in this program, I'm able to perform any of the tasks mentioned without receiving any personal recognition from my group. If, as trusted servants, we fill our positions as expected, then I can go to the treasurer with an extra contribution, and only the two of us will know about it. The reason I use that example is because I just finished the term as area treasurer. I can help out without recognition and therefore feel humble. I can remain anonymous while doing many things for the betterment of my home group and the people who attend my meeting, and no one need know that I'm the one doing these things. Knowing that my higher power provides me with the opportunity to be of service while remaining anonymous is the thing that really helps me feel humble. Now move this prospect of being available to do something for Alcoholics Anonymous beyond the group, and just try to imagine the multitude of opportunities that will be available. It boggles the mind. Once I get out of self enough to see that each time I'm presented with the opportunity to be of service to someone other than myself, I realize I am blessed. The service that I can offer in anonymity is what makes the humility I feel very valuable. Not only does my act of service help someone else, it also helps me feel more appreciative of the gifts I've received, and humility becomes more precious to me. Each time this occurs, I see my higher power at work, and I am truly humble. Although I firmly believe that general service is the way to better sobriety and more chances to feel humble, I must admit that even without being involved in general service at the district, intergroup, or area level, there are many, many opportunities for the sober alcoholic to be of service to his fellow sufferer and still remain anonymous. I can answer the AA help phones in my local community. I can assist those people in my AA community who let their names stand for service positions and help them with arrangements for service functions. I can be of service behind the scenes with any AA service function or social function. I can make myself available to help just by showing up at lots of meetings. I don't get to pick and choose where or whom I help by something I say or do. My higher power is the deciding factor as to how I may help someone in or outside of Alcoholics Anonymous. And this wonderful program of ours lets me remain anonymous while doing so. That is what gives me a true feeling of humility. Anonymity is what makes humility possible, and the help we can be to others is what makes humility precious. The more we practice the steps in our recovery, apply the traditions to our own lives, and use the concepts of service to our fellow man, the more valuable humility becomes. This, in a nutshell, is what I think makes humility this precious quality. Now, you'll notice the bell didn't ring because I couldn't slow down enough. Thank you very much.
You know, when Bob's talking about humility and service, you know, I think back to my beginnings, how I got started, you know. Anytime there was a job to be done or whatever, and I tried to hide in the background, my sponsor would raise my arm for me, you know, and that worked out real well for me. When I start thinking back, you know, all those things that I used to have to brag about a week, I'm going to do this for you or that for that person, I would brag about that to make sure everybody knew I was doing it. And because of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, I can do things for people without having to tell them. Boy, what an honor, you know, what an honor, what a gift this program has been for me. I think it's on to our next speaker now. Camilla, please.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name's Camille, and I'm a grateful alcoholic. By the grace of God, the 12 steps, sponsorship, and a lot of love and prayers, I haven't had a drink since May 2nd of 72. Now, I want to tell you, I was just two when I came in here. But I have one of my original home group members sitting over there, and he knows the truth. Because when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had absolutely no idea what was wrong with me. Now, maybe some of these other people, they've drank and drank and drank. But when I got here, I'd only been drinking for about 2.5 years. Started when I was 19 and I was 23. So I didn't know what was wrong with me. I didn't know not only what was wrong with me, but I didn't know anything about humility. I didn't know anything about life. I knew about drinking. In fact, drinking was really, if you didn't have any fun drinking, I'm sorry for you. Because I had a ball drinking. There were just a few little minor problems, like with police departments and driving somebody else's car and things like that. But when I got here, and the judge said, you know, I think you have a drinking problem. And I thought, Honor, I don't have a drinking problem. I have a lot of problems. And he said, I'm going to sentence you to go to AA. Well, AA to me was, I didn't even know about AA. Triple A. Yeah, I knew about Triple A. But anyway, so he sentenced me to go to AA. And so I went, and I called this guy up by the name of Steve. And I said, you know, you're supposed to do this 12-step on me, and I'll be in the Salt Lick Bar. Now, mind you, I couldn't drink because I was on Ambien. And so anyway, he came over and he told me about his story and how he was a cement mixer guy in Ohio. And I thought, I've never done that. I've never mixed cement and fell into it. And what I was looking at were the differences, you know, because of the last thing that I wanted to be was an alcoholic. Because I would rather have been crazy. Because I thought if you were crazy, you could have a little ECT or you could have pills or something and you'd get fixed. Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was sentenced to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. So I got on this great journey. And thank God I hit a bunch of people in Vail, Colorado that they believed in the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. In fact, when I got here, I couldn't read. I mean, I could read about Dick and Jane and Spot, but I couldn't really read the big words. There's some big words in the book, like frothy emotional appeal. Okay? Frothy emotional appeal was somebody that was foaming at the mouth and begging me, don't drink. So I couldn't understand that. Well, anyway, they read the book to me, and they explained the book and everything, and I was full of fear. I was doing everything I could not to be a member. I was waiting for them to kick me out. I did all sorts of things. If you want to know, there's a gentleman here that can tell you. But anyway, to get on to the subject here, because what I want to share with you is how I don't know whether I have not attained a level of humility that I really see some people in the program that have humility. I don't know what it's going to take because I've been kicked in the pants more than one time in here. In fact, I was thinking about different things that have happened. You know, we get here and we work the steps, and then God sort of gives us a little nudge and a little slap and a little kick. And life sometimes is really not easy. But to attain this great thing of humility, which is a founding principle of AA. The first thing that I found with humility is that I was down in Denver, and I had a hard time getting, I didn't even want to be sober, but I'd had a hard time grasping onto this thing. So I went to a Denver young people's meeting, and I said, well, maybe I'm a potential alcoholic, but I'm not there yet. So what they told me, they said, sit down, shut up, and listen. And so they said, you better pray to God. And I said, you know what? God and I are not on real good terms here. You know, and I said, this praying to God. They said, don't worry about God. Just say HP or whatever. So as I'm leaving the meeting, you know, not knowing what was wrong with me, I said, hey, pal up there, if you think I'm an alcoholic, help me not to drink anymore. And since that day to this day, I haven't had a drink. Now, that has nothing to do with me. You know? That was my first surrender. And I think that this program has many surrenders. The first thing that happens to you when you come into the program, you come in and you admit. Okay? At the time, admitting, I could have admitted I was a chair. Because I wanted you to like me. I wanted you to, I mean, I've been sort of kicked around there for a while, threatened to go to jail. And after you've been to jail at least one time, the thrill is gone on that one. Yeah. You know, and I'm a nice kid, you know, oh dear. But, you know, so you would admit, well, you know, I could have admitted all sorts of things. It didn't mean anything. They said, if you come to the meeting, it's a closed meeting, you got to admit you're an alcoholic. Well, okay, so I admit I'm an alcoholic. What does an alcoholic mean? I have absolutely no idea. Okay, but then you go through the work, and you start with the first step, and you really look at what does alcoholism mean. It means that when I take a drink, I have absolutely no idea what's going to happen. I don't know if I'm going to have one drink, two drinks, drink three drinks, drink for a four-day deal. I don't know. And then the other thing that really hit me is if I don't have a spiritual solution that works as good as alcohol did when he was working, I'm going to drink again. Because there's something wrong right in here. And I need it healed. So, I did the work. And I thought, well, after I've done the steps and I made the amends, you know, you're about 3 years sober. Well, I'm a saint. Saint Camille's come back. So I decided, this is my next brilliant decision. What I need is a man and a good job. Isn't every woman need a man and a good job? So I went out to find one. Well, I found some real dingling. I mean, you know, I found some. Oh, dear. You know, they told me my picker was broke. So I probably dated every craphead at York Street that there was, if you needed a home or something, you know. Because I was trying to get something on the outside to make me okay on the inside. Okay? I was trying to manage my life. Is that humility? Absolutely not. But I didn't know it. So I had the opportunity, and I think one of the things that's this precious gift is that nobody ever said, why don't you ask God for humility? It's a gift. It's like sobriety is a gift. I asked God for sobriety. I've asked God to do help, you know, take away my character defects more than once. I figured after I'd done the seventh step for the first time, well, I should become a saint. You should never have any defects of character. People in my home group, they know that is not true. You know, by the way, I'm a member of the St. Matthew's home group in Louisville, Kentucky. And if you are home group members, thank you. If you're ever if you're ever there on a Tuesday or a Friday night, please come and join us at 8 o'clock. It's the best home group that I know of. We have some real service-orientated people, and they are wonderful people. We talk about Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, in my definition, there's AA, BB, and Fluff and Duff. Okay? There's AA, where you share your experience, strength, and hope. There's BB, where you have it all intellectual, haven't worked a step, but you know it up here. And then there's Fluff and Duff, and they pat you on the popo, and they say, honey, just don't drink anymore. And if I would have run into a group of people that said, honey, don't drink anymore, I would have been dead. Okay, so getting back to humility. I came to not only acknowledge it. The next thing that I came to accept it. Okay, I'm an alcoholic. That means I got to go to meetings. I got to read the book. I got to work the steps. I got to sponsor people. I got to be in service. And I got to do the whole darn deal all my rest of my life. Was I a happy camper? No. Because I was almost doing it under duress. Then I got another sponsor. And see, at that time, I was driving a bus in Denver. And I was a bus driver. And she said, you want to be a bus driver for the rest of your life? I said, lady, I didn't want to be a bus driver in the first place. You know, it's not like I wanted to be Ralph Prandon and say, move it, Bond back, you know. And so she said, well, you better go to school. And I said, I don't even know how to read. Okay, there's another surrender. Humility. When you ask your sponsor to give you direction, That's a humbling fact, because what that means is that I don't know it all. And when I ask my sponsor to give me some direction, I do not tell my sponsor no. That would be a big mistake, especially the one that I had for years, carried a 38. Then the other thing is that at least I try. And we used to say in Denver, if it's not in the big book, don't worry about it. You don't have to do it. So it relieved me of worrying about having to hand out watchtowers there, you know, on the corner and saying, you got to be saved, brother. And so I was happy of that. But learning not only the steps, but I grew up in Alcoholics Anonymous. Okay? I learned how to be a woman. I didn't want to be a woman. I wanted to be I don't know what. Well, for a while I rode motorcycles and cussed like a sailor. I thought that was interesting. You know? But she said, no, you got to wear dresses and become a lady and everything. And so that was another part. See, growing up in AA, like I did, doesn't mean that you're just going to be stuck in meetings and you're just going to be gutting it out. It means that it's going to put you back into a life that you didn't know existed. Okay? So I started on that journey, and many times was I told things that I didn't want to do. I would sit there when my sponsor was giving me some good orderly direction, and I'd think, lady, you are just loony. You ought to go out there and commit yourself. Okay? But I followed her direction. I gave up my will. I asked for help. And I found what a precious gift to be able to ask for help, because I have used it when later on in school. And I went to school until now. I'm educated way beyond my capabilities. Oh. But the thing about it is that I learned how to ask for help. And you know, you talk about service jobs. I've had the great service job of being the GSR. When you're the GSR, you're the dictator of the meeting, aren't you? Yeah, but they informed me I wasn't, you know. You know, and going to service conferences, if you have never done it, I've been on the service level, on the local, the national, and the international level, and the higher you go, the worse it gets. It's just craziness. And I know this gentleman here that's almost asleep, he'll tell you. So, humility is the ability to look at myself and honestly to accept what I find. Okay? I found both the good and the bad. And there were things in me that I found that isn't who I was. See, one of the things when you write a four-step, that's not who you are. That's who you think you are. And if you don't ever write it, you're never going to know that that's not who you are. And so I wrote it for a step, and I was thinking, well, you know, you'd stay in 10, 11, and 12, and too long and down the road, and you'd be happy. Well, I'm not that kind of a drunk. I needed to write the inventory more than once. And every time that I wrote the inventory, I got over another layer of nonsense of who I thought I was, because by the time I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, even after 2.5 years of drinking, I mean, I had so much stuff around me, you couldn't have got to me if you had to, because I had all the self-protection. And I was running with a lot of fear. And when you get somebody that's running with a lot of fear, they're dangerous. And that's sort of the way I was. And just to calm them down, just to say, it's going to be okay. You don't have to drink, and you don't have to act like a damn fool either. You know, and that's a relief, you know. And to find out that I didn't have to do all these things. I didn't, you know, I thought I had to be important. And so I was going out there. I figured there was a time in my life I had driven the bus in union wages. I was making good money. I'd prance around the club and say, you know what? If you work hard and you don't drink, you too can have your American Express card. Okay? The next year I was filing bankruptcy. Okay, so be careful, because, you know, it goes up and down. So I was really having quite a time there. Then I went to the international. I didn't have much money, but I went to the international when I was on a plane. And there was a guy next to me, and I said, hi, where are you going? Well, the plane's going to Montreal. And he said, I'm going to Montreal. So I said, what you going to do up there? Well, I'm going to a convention. which we're going to. Well, I'm going to the Al-Anon convention. Okay? To make a long story short, Bob and I have been married for 23 years. So, ladies or gentlemen, going home, pay attention who's on your plane. Yeah. The last part is about surrender. You know, when you surrender to the program, the fight's over. I don't have to worry. Maybe I'm not an alcoholic. Because what I've found is that going through the work enough, I have rooted out all those little things that says, maybe you're not an alcoholic. Maybe you're different. Maybe you don't have to work those steps. Maybe you don't have to be in service. Maybe, you know. And I found them. So the fight's over. But that doesn't mean just because the fight's over, it just becomes smooth sailing, at least not for me. Because I had some other challenges. I got into some work positions that were really way beyond my capabilities. But I like to get into challenges. And there were some things that just didn't turn out right. And it really slam dunked me. And so I got a new sponsor, and I went through the steps. And one of the things that really helped me is that I was told, you're a child of God, and you're just as good as anyone. Because I figured, for whatever reason, that, you know, I wasn't as good as anyone. I thought there were people that were better than me. And what happens is when you do that, you set yourself up. And, I was told, you're a child of God, and you're just as good as anyone. I got into doing some prison work. If you want to do some real 12-step work, go work with the prisoners. It was such a healing thing to be able to work with women that really, truly, I mean, their life is on the line. If they don't get this deal, they're dead when they get out of here. Okay? But the sad thing is that our life is on the line. And if you don't do this thing, you're dead. And so many people, they don't realize it. Now, for me to be in here this long, it's just amazing, especially when I didn't even know what was wrong with me. But, you know, being an alcoholic and my life is unmanageable, today I don't have to manage my life. One of the best things that I ever learned is all I have to do is show up and report for duty. My sponsor gave me a prayer. She said, here's a prayer for you. Say, good morning, God. This is Private Camille. And I'm reporting in for duty. Okay, on my knees, you know. And so whatever your will is today is fine with me. Just give me the power to carry that out in your name. Okay? And I started doing that. And when I remember that I'm the private and God's the general, we have a good day. But I always don't remember because you know what? I still have an ego. And my ego is doing push-ups when I'm sleeping. My ego is waiting for me when I grow or get up. And it's just like the ego said, ha, 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 good morning, Camille, I'm here. And that's why you have to instantly go right into your morning meditation so you can hook up with God. Because my ego will take over for the whole day. Do 10 and 11. I have a 10-step buddy. The 10-step buddy started from some people in Denver. And the 10-step buddy I work with is that when I get, during the day, I get a little stressed, I get a little fearful, I get a little angry, I call my 10-step buddy. And I said, I got to do a 10-step. So on the other end of the line, the 10-step buddy says, well, are you full of fear? Yeah. Are you resentful? Oh, yeah. Are you a little self? Absolutely. Are you self-seeking? Yeah. Well, do you need to make any amends? And my automatic response so far has said, no, that's why I'm calling you. Because I don't have to make those amends. I'm calling you. We say a prayer and ask God to remove those things at once. And then the thing is, go out and help somebody. Okay? I live in a world that I don't work with alcoholics except for my 12-step work and my sponsorship. But I work with some serious, serious ill people. Because I was able to get a doctorate in psychology. And so I work with people that have post-traumatic stress disorder and chronic pain. And what I've found is that there are a lot of people in the world, they just suffer with silence. And what I do is I take everything that I've ever learned here and I apply it to what I'm doing. Because the amount of surrender, you can't fight. You can't fight anything, really. You can't fight pain. You can't fight cancer. You can't fight heart disease. Learning how to surrender and going with the flow, and then having these principles and these steps to be able to work. How do I find God? You know, I used to say I was always looking for God. They said, God's nowhere. He's within. How do I find God? I get away enough of the wreckage of my ego and myself that all of a sudden, God is there. It's like having a direct phone line. I have a direct phone line. I have direct access. And my direct phone line is really clear. If I am not full of fear, I'm not full of self, I'm not full of resentment, then I can hear in my meditation. I can hear what God's saying. I have intuitive thought today. And that is such a gift. How are we doing? Oh, we're good. We could do another 2 hours here. Okay. I hope your rears can stand it here. But I know I want to let George talk because I'm interested. I've known him for a while. And to hear what he has to say. But I just encourage you to keep working this program. So many times I think we get bored or we quit. I haven't been bored in Alcoholics Anonymous. I have done more service jobs right now. I'm the intergroup grapevine rep for the Louisville. And I go around and, you know, they want me to get one of those grape suits. Have you ever seen those grape suits? No, I said somebody younger and cuter can do that. I do prison work. My sponsee and I, tomorrow we're going to go volunteer. And we get to shake probably a million hands in the morning and to be of service. See, it really doesn't matter anymore what I do in Alcoholics Anonymous. I used to think, well, if I was a delegate or if I was a general manager or if I was, you know, after all, they should recognize my talents, you know. If I had some big important job. But I found the one that is most important is for me to be able to share that you don't have to drink anymore. You don't have to die anymore. That's the most important job. And I think sometimes we miss that. And to truly be one of God's kids and allow God to work with us. I've been reading about humility, and someday I hope to be able to attain it, because it is such a wonderful way to be. I mean, it's truly, you're just selfless. You're just kind. It's being kind. It's being tolerant. It's being loving. It's being caring. There's a friend of mine by the name of Tom I, and I just love him, because when you're talking to Tom, there's nobody else in the world. Okay? That's something that I admire. Okay? Being truly humble is a gift, and I think that every one of us in this room can get that. But you pray for it, and you do the steps, and you don't drink, and you try to help another human being. Thank you.
Wow. You know, I heard a lot about the journey. And I'm thinking, when I first got here to AA, I didn't look at it much as a journey. You know, I read in there that word trudge, you know, and I'm thinking, trudge the road to a happy destiny. And I went, when the hell's this going to happen? Because it wasn't. And it wasn't until, like I just now heard, until I was able to surrender. I mean, truly surrender. You know, I quit a lot of times. But it wasn't until I truly surrendered and began to incorporate the 12 steps into my life that things begun to happen. You know, and I used to think that I was a social drinker. You know, you drink, so shall I. That's the way I handled it, you know. And it just wasn't working anymore. It just wasn't working anymore. You know, and I told you before, for me to do something good for somebody, wow, I'd have to have a broken arm or it would be really twisted bad before I'd help the guy next door. You know, my neighbors used to come over and shovel my driveway for me, and the only thing I knew how to do was offer them a beer. I didn't know how to say thank you or anything. You know, I expected them to do that. I expected my neighbors to do those things for me. You know, today I'm a good neighbor. Today I'm a good neighbor because of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. We still have one more speaker on our agenda, and that's George, you know. And I'm waiting to hear what George has to say. George, if you please.
Well, my name is George, and I'm an alcoholic, and wonderful to see so many humble AAs out here at this work. You know, I'm 83 years old, and we got here on Tuesday, and I haven't had enough sleep, and I'm, as a old-timers, extreme old-timers like me are wont to do, I've sort of subsisted on coffee, cigars, and ice cream. And, you know, I really have got to remember I'm not 80 anymore. I'm pretty tired. The trouble with speaking last on a topic is the first two speakers, as was the case today, they usually say what I want to say and say it better, so which is makes things kind of tough. You know, Rick from GSO picks speakers for this panel, and when I got the invitation, I recognized that although Rick is a good Minnesota boy, he has a perverse sense of humor. And the news that I was going to speak on humility has caused a great deal of glee among my sponsees and friends in New York City, where I live now. They're just having a terrific time with us. A couple of them say, we're going to have a humility breakfast. But some of them said rather unkind things. One of them said, well, why did they pick you for a topic in which you are completely unqualified to speak on? And another one said, George, another sponsee said, George, you better do some research. You don't have any experience. But, you know, I was thinking about this. When I'm given a topic, I usually try to organize my thoughts, and I haven't been able to do that very well on this particular topic because, to tell you the truth, I don't think standing behind a microphone before 600 people or whatever's in here is a particularly good way to talk about humility. It's almost an oxymoron of some kind. The place to talk about humility is one-on-one or two or three or four in a New York diner after a 10 o'clock meeting, or wherever you live, your equivalents of a New York diner. That's where we can take each other's inventory and help each other with our humility. And so I wanted to be careful how I approach this. I'm a member of a large, historic, 190-year-old church in Upper East Side of Manhattan. And they have a 180-year-old custom, maybe, where on the last Sunday in January, president of the Board of Trustees, but the board puts on the service. The ministers have to sit out with the congregants, and the president of the board gives the sermon. So they have a big bulletin board outside the church on Lexington Avenue, and for the week before the Sunday, they write on the bulletin board, Sunday, January, whatever, George Dorsey preaching. And, you know, my AA friends love that. They said, what's new about that? George preaches all the time. So I really want to be careful this afternoon and try not to preach and try not to pontificate, because I know I can be pretty good at that when I get wound up and just share some of my own personal experiences. You know, I heard somebody just this weekend talking about there's working on humility. I don't know how you work on humility, to be honest with you. And to be honest with you, I don't know whether I ever experience, I don't know for sure whether I ever experience one single humble moment. But I am increasingly aware of the moments when I am obviously not humble. And I get a lot of help from my sponsees who are not in the least bit intimidated by the length of my sobriety or anything else. And I don't want to intimidate them. I want them to treat me as another drunk. We're just sharing and with a little more experience. But we're just peers. We're just one drunk sharing with each other. And that's the way I try to sponsor people. I don't try to teach the steps. I don't think it's an academic program to begin with. It's a spiritual program. We can learn it, but this is just my view. We basically can't teach it. And my understanding of this, of our spiritual principles and my application of them or attempt to apply them to my own life works for me, but that doesn't mean it's going to work for somebody else. What's important with the guys I sponsor is that they've reached their own understanding of the spiritual principles in AA, and they've reached their own understanding of how to live their life using these principles. Now, there I go again preaching. I got to stop this. Dr. Thiebaud talks about the ego reduction in depth that occurs to us when we come to Alcoholics Anonymous. And that was certainly true of me. The first time, I guess the ego hadn't been reduced enough. I was quite young. And that's a long time ago, obviously. And there weren't that many young people in AA. And I had a decent job and a decent car and decent clothes. I was getting arrested a lot and having a lot of accidents and getting fired from time to time. But I could have been in worse shape. And, I felt that I was nice looking, well educated and all that, and getting sober. I should be an AA poster boy. And I set out to be an AA poster boy. And I remember, this happened so long ago, and the memory is so vivid. I had been passed over for a promotion at work, to which I felt that I was totally entitled. After all, I'd been sober 18 or 20 months, and was doing a good job, working hard. So I went out to the old 6300 club in Los Angeles, a Milano club, right after work, full of self-pity. And the manager of the club was the only guy there, and he was Sully Sullivan. He's dead many, many years. He was an Irishman with the kindest, sweetest Irish face you ever saw. And he listened to me dump the garbage for about 5 minutes about this terrible thing that I hadn't received a promotion. And finally, I ran out of breath, I guess, and he said, "You know, George, I'd really like to talk to your boss." I said, "Geez, Sully, what would you tell him?" He said, "Well, George, I'd tell him that he'd made a very wise decision." And I'd go on and add that if he had you doing anything of a responsible nature, he was in trouble. He says, "I've seen your kind before, George. You may eventually get sober, but you're going to have to wash dishes on Hollywood Boulevard for a while before you do." And, of course, Sully was right. I didn't have to wash the dishes, but I was ready to. And at the end of my last drunk, with the complete surrender, the complete ego reduction in depth, I was laying in MacArthur Park in L.A., and Sully was dead by that time. But it was like he was standing next to me, and I said, aloud, "Sully, okay, I'll go wash the dishes." I was in a position where everything, this guy that I thought I was supposed to be, the AA poster boy, the successful executive, the this, the that, they're all out of the question. I just demolished all of it. And the ego was reduced in depth. I knew if I kept on drinking, I was had somewhere between 24 hours and a year to live. But I didn't know what would happen to me if I would stayed sober. It was just a total surrender at that point. I said, "Well, if I can get up out of this park and manage to," I never left AA during these slips. I'd come to meetings drinking, which didn't upset anybody in those days. And I'm going to keep trying. You know, it took me a year before I figured out what my sobriety date was, because I wasn't going to think about it when I walked out of the park. I was just going to try to stay sober. I'd been in and out too long to worry about a sobriety date. I was just going to try and see what happened, see what life brought. So life's gone on, you know, for... last drink was in 1961. I'm pushing the 50-year mark in about 15 to 16 months. But... you know, things happen. You do get successful in business. And Dr. Tiba talks about the ego rising phoenix-like from the ashes of our pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. So I'm going to talk about humility in the old-timer, which I guess I'm qualified. I mean, at least from the standpoint of being an old-timer, I'm qualified. My partner, who's been sober 44 years, says only half facetiously that Alcoholics Anonymous can be bad for alcoholics who have long-term sobriety. And he's only partly facetious. It can be if we use the length of our sobriety as our claim to fame, as an entitlement to some kind of respect or attention. That's not healthy for us. And I don't know whether you've seen it. I've seen it. I've seen it in myself at times. Boy, it scares the hell out of me once I see it. And the panelists have talked about general service. I got involved in general service after about 12 years of sobriety. I had ignored it before because I thought it was too much like the Kiwanis clubs or the Lions clubs, and I didn't want any part of that. But then I got involved, and I gradually sank all the way to the very, very bottom of the inverted triangle. Everybody in AA was my boss. And you have to watch that. I was a delegate at the General Service Conference in 1976, and I chaired the Finance Committee, which was kind of strange since I did have a background in finance. It usually doesn't work out that way. And the Finance Committee and the conference ultimately passed an action that had a lasting effect on the way the General Service Board looks at finances at that level. And after I got home, I got a letter on personal stationery, handwritten, from Bob H., who was the general manager at that time, talking about what a remarkable thing I'd done. And I wrote him back and thanked him for the letter. I said, I'm not comfortable with my motives. Did I do this because I was trying to make a contribution to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, or because I was looking for the recognition and appreciation from somebody that you expressed in the letter that you wrote to me? And so then Bob wrote me back again. He was my mentor, really. He was a great, great man. But he wrote back and said, I used to worry about that, but don't worry about that. You know, if we all waited till our motives were pure, nothing would happen in Alcoholics Anonymous. This is Bernard Smith, the non-alcoholic chairman of the board, who, working with Bill, put together the whole service structure of AA. One set of Bill that seldom in human history have such great achievements resulted from a person who had such dubious motives. And Bill fought to humility all the time. So in my long, long, long years in service, maybe I could count a half a dozen people. One of them was a non-alcoholic chairman of the board whose service was completely, totally without any ego at all. The rest of us, we have to wrestle with this thing. After 8 years of 8 or 10 years of sobriety, I realized that there was a lot of gifts that I didn't have. I'm not creative. I'm not particularly good I'm terrible with my hands. I can't even paint a wall adequately. Yeah, but it seemed to me I did have some kind of a gift for leadership. Small gift, but began to appear that way, both inside and outside AA. So if God or higher power has given me some kind of a gift, then I really should use it in an effort to be of love and service in all my affairs. But that kind of a gift is very dangerous because it's frequently accompanied by an excessive appreciation of control and power and all the things that go with a bad ego. And I realized somewhere along the line, I'm not going to get rid of those bad little monkeys on my back that are a little too fond of control and power. But if I'm going to keep on doing things that require a little bit of leadership, I just have to keep a very close eye on them. Don't lose sight of them. They're there. They're always going to be there. And for most of us, they never go away completely. They didn't for Bill. Why should they for me? Just know they're there. I just try to know they're there, and I try my best to keep an eye on them. I don't know what's happened with the time, but I think in AA, panelists have talked about anonymity, and the real, we put way too much stress on the public, on the 11th tradition, and we all know what the 11th tradition is. But I really, for a long time, have thought so deeply about the 12th tradition, which has to do not with breaking your anonymity at the public level or breaking your anonymity at the personal level within the fellowship. It's the way you feel that we relate to each other. And the best statement that I know, and I read it a long time ago and I've believed in it for a long time, is in the conclusion of Bill's essay on the 12th tradition in the 12 and 12, in which he says, moved by the spirit of anonymity, we try to give up our natural desires for personal distinction. I mean, Bill is very gentle. He doesn't say this abnormal or egomaniacal. Our natural desires for personal distinction. It's not unnatural to have a desire for personal distinction. As AA members, both among fellow alcoholics and before the general public. And the key to that sentence to me is among fellow alcoholics. I've really have tried, probably not too good at times, to give up the desire for personal distinction among my fellow alcoholics. And great to be here with all you humble folks.
You know, as George was speaking, and I'm thinking, you know, the way my AA story kind of goes is, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and my ego was still running my life. And I was asked to speak at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous the very first time. And not only that, it was an anniversary meeting. And I had to do a good job, you know. So I spent several weeks preparing and making out 3x5 cards. And I got to the meeting, and I was ready to go. I had about 2 hours worth of cards. And I was informed at that time that I had 25 minutes, you know, and I had to shuffle through those cards. And you talk about ego deflation, you know, I learned real quick, you know, I learned real quick to let God be in charge, you know, and I should have known that from the start. See, I'm a product of a treatment center, and I wasn't out of treatment 15 minutes before I made a tape about everything I knew about Alcoholics Anonymous. And let me tell you, you know, it's been some years now, and I still have that tape. So I get put back in line real quick because I can still listen to it. I've got it locked away, I will say. And I would like to think that when I'm gone, the tape disappears, you know. You know, I'm real glad to be here. I've had the opportunity in my sobriety to come to a lot of these international conventions, and it never ceases to amaze me what takes place here, you know. Three wonderful speakers today, you know. People I never met before. just walk in the streets or the halls. You know, that's not the kind of a drunk I was. I don't know. That's not the kind of a drunk I was. I wouldn't want to talk to any one of you if I was in a bar. That's just the way I was. You know, I'm real glad to be here, and I'm real glad to be sober, and I'd like another round of applause for our speakers.